When I was a kid, I wanted to be one of three things. Either an astronomer, a Roman Catholic priest — I was born and raised Roman Catholic originally — or the President of the United States. I was born and raised American, by the way. And these alternate depending upon what was going on in the world at the time. When the Viking expedition landed on Mars, oh, it was definitely an astronomer. When Pope John Paul II visited London, it was definitely Pope, I mean priest. And when the presidential election was in full swing, I'd go to bed humming "Hail to the Chief." But in high school, one by one, all those dreams came crashing down. In high school, I encountered, to my horror, algebra and trigonometry, which put an end to astronomy. I discovered, to my frustration, girls, which put an end to being a Roman Catholic priest. And I realized that to be president, I would probably need to learn how to be friendly and get people to like me. So much for that. Now, later in life, it struck me that all those varied career paths — astronomer, priest, politician — all, the driving desire was to try to dig as deeply as possible into things and ultimately figure out whatever I thought was the most important thing in the world at the time. Solve the mysteries of the cosmos. Solve God, understand Him. Solve world problems, bring peace to the Middle East, maybe get a Nobel Peace Prize in the process, right? It's pretty idealistic stuff, but you kind of want a little bit of idealism in a 7-year-old, I think. But that kind of perspective, that kind of idealism, starts to sound increasingly crazy as you get older. Right? Maybe that's kind of sad in a way, but here's the thing. The urge to figure it all out, or to fix the world, at the heart of it, it's all about control. It's all about control. It's driven by a need to sort of order the world you live in, to make sense of that world, or to impose some sense upon it, the sense you believe should be there. And the nature of getting older is that you are shown limits. You're shown limits to what you can control. You're shown limits to what you can know. You're shown that there are limits to finally what you will be able to do in this limited lifetime. To quote Dirty Harry from the Dirty Harry movies, "A man's got to know his limitations." And that's not just true for you and me personally. That's true for humanity generally. You might remember that World War I was called the war to end all wars. Well, in light of the rest of the 20th century, that just seems unbelievably naive. It's like a sort of a collective 7-year-old thought. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes, which we've been marching through for the past few weeks, and which I believe the plan is to wrap up next week, the book of Ecclesiastes is fundamentally about human limits. And specifically here in chapter 7, it's the limits of human wisdom. The context is we're sitting alongside the deathbed of a man who is seemingly without any limits. It's King Solomon. He's lost his name. He's now Koheleth, the preacher, the teacher, literally the assembler, the one who assembles the congregation of Israel together, a king. And he's without, seems, any limits. No limits to his wealth, no limits to his wives. And important for us this morning, seemingly no limits to his wisdom, although check the previous point. And he's gathered us, he's assembled us around his deathbed to hear him attempt to work through what went so horribly wrong. How did things go so terribly wrong for him and for Israel? Now, I think Solomon might just be the most tragic figure in all the scriptures. He's the wisest, richest man in the world. He's blessed by God, but in the end, he falls away from the Lord and he turns to idols. And all of his wealth and all of his wisdom count for nothing in the end, zippo, because his legacy is a divided kingdom, and the destiny of both those parts is utter destruction. As one scholar put it, even if Solomon answers all the riddles of the Queen of Sheba, 1 Kings 10, he must also pass God's test of obedience to the revealed law. And he fails. So, How does the wisest man in the world mess things up this badly? That's the question. Why couldn't my wisdom, Solomon asked, why couldn't my wisdom, which was a gift from God, no less, keep me on the straight and narrow and save me and my kingdom? And he comes, I think, to the best answer he can in this chapter, which I take to be the climax of the book, if you will. So I want to ask three questions as we turn to the text. The first, where does human wisdom work well? Where does human wisdom work well? Where does human wisdom fail? Second question, what's the fallout of that failure? And that's the bulk of where we're going to be exploring this morning. And where is there hope in wisdom? So where does it work? Where does it fail? And where's the hope? So where does wisdom work well? Let's turn to verse 11 if you have your Bibles with you, or if you find them under the seat somewhere. In verse 11, he says, wisdom is good with, or sort of more like as with, wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. It's a pretty good analogy. Wisdom is like an inheritance. It's just like money. And ideally, what do you do with money? Hopefully, you're not just hoarding it. You use it to live. You use it to survive. Put a roof over your head, to put food on the table, to provide for your children. And if you're a king, you use it to prosper your kingdom, to keep your subjects safe, a good king at least. It's a tool to help you live life. And it's the same with wisdom. It's a tool for living. It's a tool for prospering, for keeping you and yours safe. And if you're a king, it's a tool for good ruling. Solomon is at his shining best in 1 Kings 3, the third chapter of 1 Kings, the story of the two women with the child, if you're familiar with it. Two women, each had a baby. One of those babies died, and both come before King Solomon, each claiming that the living baby is theirs. So Solomon, in wisdom, orders the baby cut in two, and each mother given a half. Brilliant. The real mother steps forward and says, oh, no, don't kill my child, don't kill the child. Give her to that woman. Right? Real mother's the one who begs for the child's life. That's wisdom. Discerning hearts, weighing options, figuring out problems, developing solutions to things that are happening in life. The second part of the Ten Commandments, all the bits about how you relate to your neighbor, those commandments align perfectly with wisdom. Yes, they're God's revealed law, but they're also, frankly, some very wise prescriptions for a stable society. You don't get a stable society around for very long if you don't have some version of those commandments operating. Honor your parents. A society that doesn't have some notion of generational responsibility is going to fall in on itself. Don't murder. Seems pretty obvious. A society that doesn't regulate killing is going to kill itself. Don't commit adultery. A society that doesn't, whether it's legally or culturally, regulate sexual relations and familial relations is going to fall apart at the seams. Right? You can keep going, so forth and so on. You get the idea. And you use this kind of wisdom every day in your life. If you're going to take on a new job, you think about what's it mean for you? What's it mean for your commute? What's it mean for your career path? What's it mean for your family? What's it mean for ultimately when you get to retire or what the rest of your life looks like? If you're thinking about getting married, well, that's probably a bad example. Wisdom's kind of sometimes takes the back seat on that one. Raising children, with a lot of wisdom. Probably more prayer, but a lot of wisdom. But the point is, wisdom is fundamentally at its best when you see it as a tool for getting through life as best you can, and particularly for getting through life with other people. And it's summed up again and again for Koheleth in what Todd was talking about last week. Enjoy your life. Enjoy your food. Enjoy your drink. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your spouse. Enjoy being with the people you love. That in fear of the Lord, of course, but I strongly suspect that's going to be a big ticket item next week, so I'm going to steer clear of that right now. But in working through what the good of wisdom is, we've kind of naturally begun to answer our second question. Where does wisdom begin to fail? Let's look at verses 11 and 12 again. Koheleth says, wisdom is an advantage to those who see the sun. And then he says, the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. He's reining it in very tightly there. Money doesn't help you when you're dead. Neither does wisdom. If wisdom is a tool for living life, that means it doesn't necessarily have any answers about what that life isn't supposed to mean, for example. It can't necessarily tell you why you're here. It can't necessarily tell you where you're going or where the world is going. Move into that kind of framework of questioning, and wisdom begins to collapse. How do I stop my son from tearing my kingdom apart and leading it to utter destruction? Likewise, how can I guarantee my kid won't blow my inheritance, move to Vancouver, and marry some rock guitarist? How can we stop tsunamis? How can we stop groups like ISIS from ever hurting innocent people again? How can I prove for certain, forget faith, but I want to know, prove for certain there's a God and there's life after death? And how can I figure out what that hypothetical God wants of me to get that? Wisdom can't help you with those things. Well, maybe to suggest you should work a little better with your relationship with your kids. That's about it. Wisdom has a very, very narrow focus. It's for your time under the sun, as Koheleth likes to put it. Sorting out the meaning of life in the world? What's it all about, Alfie? Where is it going? That's beyond its pay grade. And if you do try to apply wisdom to those types of questions, you are likely to come to some disturbing conclusions. Verse 13. Consider, look at, see the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? That's a very logical end to that line of inquiry. God made a bad world beyond fixing. And you can actually see this get played out in the news media every time something disastrous or tragic happens, right? When those things happen, the news media tend to look for pastors and spiritual leaders, drag them out of the closets, put them on TV, and they'll ask them, so what are you going to tell your congregation this Sunday? What are you going to say about why God would let something like this happen in the world? And the truth is, there are only so many possible answers to that question. God isn't powerful enough to stop it. Okay, bad answer. God doesn't care. Bad answer. God is punishing people for their sin. Really bad answer. I don't know. That's another possible answer. And you can typically watch these guys nervously tap dance through the answer. But that's because they're tap dancing beyond the limits of human wisdom. Because from the vantage point of human wisdom, something's got to be crooked, either with God or the world or both. Now, the best answer that human wisdom can offer of those options is, I don't know. I don't know. But who wants to get on television and say, I don't know? And it gets worse in light of verse 13. Because in a world made crooked by God, even the good part of wisdom, wisdom for living a good life, even that begins to collapse. If you look at verse 14, what's he saying? God has given you both good days and bad days just to keep you off balance, keep you uncertain about things. Verse 15, good people get burned doing good and bad people are rewarded doing bad. So, I guess forget everything I just said about living wisely. What's the point? Because if God really did make a messed up creation, there is no basis for living a wise life. God doesn't care. At the very least, he's not worth caring about what he cares. And Nietzsche's right. God's dead. Forget the good. It's everybody for themselves. Survival of the fittest. Dog eat dog. Good luck. And that line of questioning leads Solomon down a very dark road. And he shares that with us at the end of the chapter, verse 25, jumping all the way ahead. Verse 25, he says, I turn my heart to know and to seek out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things, and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. Let's stop there. Notice that word schemes. Schemes. He's going to keep using it in the next few verses. It can be translated as invention or device. It's even used elsewhere in the Bible to describe war machines like catapults. And the point is, it's a contrivance. It's something of our own making. But notice how Koheleth keeps conflating it with wisdom. He's seeking after these schemes. He's also pursuing wisdom. He's blurred his pursuit of wisdom with his own pursuit of his schemes. Let's keep reading, verse 26. And I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. Let's stop again. Who's this woman? And there's another woman coming up very shortly. Now, to be clear, Koheleth is not just some cranky old dying misogynist. Honestly, there are a lot of critics out there that that's their best answer for this. He's got something very specific in mind. In the book of Proverbs, but also elsewhere in wisdom literature generally, there are two women who act as figures or symbols. One is Lady Wisdom, the other is Dame Folly. Lady Wisdom, my wife has warned me that if I go down this road, nobody's going to be listening to me for the rest of the sermon because I'm about to disagree with the entire internet. But Lady Wisdom is the woman of Proverbs 31. You've heard Proverbs 31, woman. It's not ultimately about what it means to be a good wife. Rather, what's happening is it's a portrait of an ideal wife to show you what Lady Wisdom looks like. It's about who Lady Wisdom is and why you should want to marry Lady Wisdom. It's the picture of true wisdom. We'll get back to her, but she's not the one Koheleth has found. He's been chasing Dame Folly the whole time. This is Proverbs 9 describing Dame Folly. The woman Folly is loud. She's seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of the house. She takes a seat on the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. And that's worse than death. That's the dark road Solomon or Koheleth has wandered off on. Dame Folly separates you from God. Psalm 6 says, "For in death there's no remembrance of you. In Sheol, who will give you praise?" Isaiah 38, "For Sheol does not thank you. Death does not praise you. Those who go down to the pit do not hope for your faithfulness." And so that's the first part of what he found. That's the result in his life. Dame Folly, death, and separation from God. Let's skip ahead a little to verse 27 for the second part of his discovery. He says, "Behold, this is what I found," says the preacher. Note, there's our frame narrator. Right? We haven't seen much of him. He comes in, he's sort of like a movie voiceover. He comes in at the beginning in chapter 1 to introduce you to Koheleth. He's going to come in a lot in the very last lines of the book. But otherwise, he's completely silent from chapter 2 to chapter 11, except here. Right? So this is big red attention signs going off right now. Pay attention is what he's saying. "Behold, this is what I found," says the preacher, "while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man or person among a thousand I found, but a woman among these I have not found." The woman he cannot find is Lady Wisdom. Think of the question about her in Proverbs 31:10. Who can find an excellent wife, one more precious than jewels? Well, at the end of the day, Koheleth can't find her. Because, well, at the end of the day, he's not really even looking for her. Last verse, verse 29. "See, this alone I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." And so there it is. It's not that God made a crooked world. God made a straight world. God made a good world. He even made us upright and good. But it's our seeking after these schemes, our devices and our inventions, that has distorted us. We trade finding true wisdom for chasing after our own schemes. And so the limit to human wisdom isn't finally a problem with our brains. It's a problem with our hearts. You see, we totally get the second tablet of the Ten Commandments, all the commandments about the neighbors that we've talked about. What we don't get on our own, and what we actively rebel against even once we've been told it, is the first tablet, all the commandments about God. All that stuff about not having other gods before him, all that stuff about not worshiping idols. As Calvin put it, the human heart is an idol factory. It is an assembly line of schemes. How's the old saying go? God created man in his image, and humans have spent all of history trying to repay the favor. And that's exactly what Solomon did. He's turned from worshiping God to worshiping idols. And it's not for lack of wisdom he does so. It's all because of an ordinary, universal dose of human sinfulness. As Kohelet says in verse 22, "He who pleases God escapes her, Dame Folly. But the sinner is taken by her." The sinner is taken by her. Well, so where does our hope lie? Well, the point of all this is that at the limits of human wisdom, you don't need to seek anymore. You can stop working so hard on all your schemes. Because beyond those limits, you quite simply need God to tell you what you need to know, which he has done. Solomon's certainly been told. He built the temple. And yet in verse 23, Kohelet describes how far away wisdom was for him, how far away it was, how very, very deep. But that's the tragic irony of Kohelet. Lady Wisdom is actually really, really easy to find. In Proverbs 1, she cries aloud in the streets. She cries aloud in the gates. She raises her voice in the markets. I like to pick up my daughter, and I like to throw her behind my back. I hope this doesn't sound like I'm torturing the poor girl. But I throw her behind my back, and I like to pretend like I don't know where she is. "Mama, Mama, have you seen Zoe? I think we might have left her at home." And she's just there throwing her arms around. "I'm right here. I'm right here." That's what Lady Wisdom is like, maybe a little less loud. She's right in front of you. She's right next to you. She's easy to find. The only way not to find her, Proverbs 1:29, "Hate knowledge and choose not to fear the Lord." Block your ears to the Lord and say, "I don't hear you." Why would you block your ears, though? Why would a wise man like Solomon turn away? Because no amount of our wisdom can ever cure our sin. No amount of our wisdom can ever reverse the fact that although God made us upright, we seek our own truth, we look to invent our own schemes. It's been the same since Genesis 3. It's the sin of the Garden of Eden. Ignore what God says loud and clear, figure out for yourself what good and evil is, and thereby try to figure out how you can be like God. Kohelet rightly says in verse 20, "Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins." That's true. But St. Paul turns it up to 11. Romans 3, "No one is righteous, no, not a one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside." That's the human condition, and that's the problem. There's the limit of human wisdom. No one actually seeks, at least on their own, for God. We are so bent and crooked, broken and ashamed, that we want to hide from God, forget go looking for him. Spiritual searches and journeys, at least in my experience, tend to be all about running in the opposite direction. But here's the good news. You might not seek for God, but he's come after you. And that's what Solomon or Kohelet completely forgot. The revealed law of God that was so close and yet so tragically far from him begins with a simple statement that God is the one who seeks, he's the one who finds, and he's the one who redeems. Exodus 20, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of slavery." God comes after you. That's who God is. That's who God is first and foremost for his children. He is the one who seeks after his children, even when they're not looking for him. And so if you are here this morning, no matter where you are in your spiritual journey, no matter how near or far you feel you are, the good news for you is this: he has most certainly already found you. You see, when the wisdom of Solomon, or your wisdom or my wisdom for that matter, when the wisdom of Solomon goes into this mess of the world and all our lives, it's only ever going to be to try to make sense of that mess, and that probably badly. But honestly, we don't need answers to this mess we're in, to this mess we are in and of ourselves. We need to be saved from it, and we need to be saved from ourselves. Because there's simply no way out on the shoulders of wisdom. But when the wisdom of God and Jesus Christ comes to this same mess of the world, it's not to make sense of it, but to take that mess upon his shoulders and nail it to the cross. And that wisdom of the cross and resurrection does something far better than make sense of things for us. It finds us, it redeems us, it saves us, and it declares that the final word over all things, despite everything your human wisdom might tell you about your life in the world, is hope. And it is a hope you've got to be told, because it's too good for your wisdom to ever make up. And that's because it's not hope in answers, it's not hope in understanding or plans or schemes, it's a hope in a person. Because we've seen who Jesus Christ is and what he did for us on the cross, because we've seen that, we can know and trust that the very heart of God for the world, for you and for me, is for us. God doesn't always give answers. I wish he did to a lot of things. But in Christ, he has revealed fully who he is. And trusting in him on those grounds of Christ and him crucified is the truest wisdom there is. Amen.